This is Digital Story Podcast number 583, May 9th, 2017. Today's theme is, What Separates You from the Other Guy? I'm Derek Story. There are millions of smartphone cameras out there clicking billions of photos every year. Styles range from snaps of a sweetheart to attempts at fine art. Now, more than before, everyone is a photographer. Which is great, that is, unless photography happens to be your craft. And if it is, how do you distinguish your work from those who don't know the difference between an f-stop and a bus stop? Thoughts about this and much more on today's TDS podcast. My friend Oliver is staying at the studio during his visit here from Germany. When he first arrived, I was showing him around the place, and he noticed the film cameras that I had out for testing. "You're shooting film?" he asked. "Yes, I am," I answered, "for both fun and business." I then told him about the film camera shop on Etsy that I run. After I laid out the whole game plan for him, he asked, "Well, why wouldn't people just buy something dirt cheap on eBay rather than paying a bit more from you?" "It's all about quality and consistency," I replied. "When you buy on eBay, you really don't know what you're going to receive. Believe me, I know firsthand. But when you make a purchase from the film camera shop, you know that you're going to get a clean, properly functioning camera that is packed nicely and arrives on time. And judging by the popularity of the store, those qualities are important to a lot of people. This is the same approach that I apply to working with clients and to making pictures. And if you're interested in distinguishing your work from others, you might want to think about these five suggestions. Now, at first, you may say, "Well, that's easy. I mean, they're just casual snapshooters, and I'm an artist, or I'm a professional, or I'm a freelancer." Well, a lot of those casual snapshooters are pretty good. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of great work online, and there's some good stuff on Facebook, too. So it's not as simple as just saying, "Hey, I am better than them, or I'm more serious than them, therefore my pictures are better, too." But there are specific things that you can do that elevate your game. And those are the five things I'm going to talk about right now. First one, practice using the best light possible. And I find this constantly amazing, I have to tell you. I'll walk up to a subject or I'll see a subject and I'll get close to it so I can photograph it. And I'll notice how the light is falling on the subject, and I'll notice what's going on with the background lighting and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of times I'll just take a shot first thing, because I've got this thing that whenever I see a shot, I take a shot just to have it in the bank. And, you know, that started with wild animals and kids, right? Because they tend to flee quickly. But then I just started doing it as a matter of course. And sometimes it's a reference shot, and sometimes it's more than that. But at any rate, that is my practice. But then after that, as I've talked about many times, then I'll really start looking at it and going, "Wow, you know, it's funny. If I just walk 4 steps to the right, all the reflections on that surface change, and the light itself looks a lot different. Suddenly I see more detail in the subject, or there are fewer distraction spectral highlights, or, you know, whatever it happens to be." And it's amazing to me how many times just a few steps one direction or the other will change the shot completely. And then, of course, there are those shots where you have control over where the subject is. So, for instance, if you're doing a portrait, you have a choice. You can stand your portrait subject out in broad daylight in the middle of the day and take a picture, or you can move him under a tree and photograph him that way, or you can find an open window and get some nice light streaming in and photograph him that way. I mean, there are all sorts of ways that you can manipulate the lighting and the position of the subject relative to the lighting just by having your eyes on, just by going, "You know what? I have a north-facing window, which I do here at the studio, which I absolutely love. Everything that artists have been raving about for years about north-facing windows is absolutely true. The light is beautiful through a north-facing window. And I can use that window to my advantage for both product shooting and portraits and all that kind of stuff. So I can put the subject right next to the window. I can move the subject back from the window. Just those minor movements make a lot of difference. And this is something where practice does improve your skill. You do see better with practice when you're thinking about it. So practice using the best light possible. Think about it. Play with it. Work with it. Make it, when you can, be a matter of course to adjust either your position or the position of your subject to get the best light possible. That one thing alone, I'll tell you, will separate your work from a lot of work that's out there. Next, compose with great care. Now, two things that I see in terms of just bad composition or mistakes made when composing a shot are very basic, and you're going to know these, but we forget them. Number one, you have to pay attention to distracting background elements. We get so zoomed in on the subject with our eyes. There's a subject. That's all we see. Wow, what a subject. Wow, he's handsome. Wow, she's beautiful. Wow, that cat has really nice fur. You know, whatever it happens to be. But we become totally fixated on the subject and forget about all the distracting things in the background, things sticking out of the subject's head and so forth. So pay attention to the background. Really look for distracting background elements. And again, this is something I find myself doing a lot. Remember a few weeks ago, I was talking about the wedding that I went to, and I was doing a lot of group shots and things like that. And I would get people lined up. And I wasn't even the photographer, right? I was just a guy with a camera. I was a civilian, remember? And I would get people lined up, and then I would focus on them. And then before I took the shot, I would look at how the background is interacting with the subjects. And I'll tell you, half the time, there was something coming out of someone's head, and I had to take a step to the right or the left to make that work. Over and over again, I find myself making that correction. You've got to pay attention to the background. Now, the other thing that I think is important is pay attention to all four corners of the frame. So as you're looking at your shot and as you're composing it, once you make sure that you don't have telephone poles sticking out someone's head, then go to the upper left corner, the upper right corner, lower right corner, lower left corner, and see what's going on there. For instance, if you have, let's say, a really bright area down in the lower right corner, well, then you're probably going to have to crop it out later, and you may not want to crop it out because then it changes the dimensions of the frame or it does something else to the shot that you don't want. So it's better and easier just to take a step to the left or right while you're taking the picture than it is to have to deal with it later on. Remember, in post-production, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, I like using post-production to make the image better, not to correct the mistakes that I made at capture. So practice using the best light possible and then compose with great care. Now, getting to post-production, which is point number three, post-production is important. It really is. So whether you're taking advantage of the filters and adjustments in Instagram or the advanced controls in Lightroom and Luminar, post-production matters. And I think Instagram is a great example because it's a tool that a lot of casual photographers use as well as a lot of serious photographers. And one of the things I've noticed that happens, casual photographers will shoot a shot and they'll shoot it right up to Instagram. And serious photographers will take advantage of all those filters, of all those slider adjustments that are in Instagram, edit the shot a bit, and then push it up. Now, I know there's a hashtag in Instagram that's hashtag no filter, and that is a badge of honor of sorts. However, that being said, I would rather not have the hashtag no filter and have a shot that makes an impact. So I'm not really hung up on, you know, having a shot that is pure capture. If you are, that's great. Hats off to you. However, most of the photography that I see out there can be improved with some very simple post-production. I'm not I'm not even talking about fixing mistakes. I'm talking about just making it a better shot. And I think having an eye for post-production and knowing what to do with color, knowing what to do with the various tools that you have available to you, whether they're in Instagram or Lightroom or Luminar, whatever you happen to be using, being familiar with those tools and the things that you can do with them will help you separate your photography from a lot of other folks, because we get used to these tools. We know what they can do. We're comfortable with them. And we don't realize that a lot of other people really don't think about those tools, really aren't comfortable with them, and have no idea what to do with them. So learning those tools and then using them to our advantage, again, elevates our work. The next point, number four, speaking of elevation, presentation elevates. And I just did this experiment because I've been writing this book on creative printing. And by the way, I'm loving this book. It's going to be out in June. It's going to come out at the Out of Chicago conference. That's where I'm going to release it. And this is a book that's going to be available for free to everyone who attends any of my classes at Out of Chicago. So, and then of course it'll be available to everyone else through iBooks and all that other stuff. At any rate, I ran across this experiment while working on one of the chapters of this book, where I took an Instagram shot. Actually, I took a series of Instagram shots that I did and that I liked, that I liked them on Instagram. And then I printed them. I framed them. They were behind mats, you know, really did some nice presentation. And then I step back and I look at them. And I liked them when they were on Instagram, and they were fun to look at on my iPhone. But I loved them when they were printed, matted, and framed. And I'm not talking about spending a lot of money. I mean, I have the links to all the stuff in this ebook that I'm working on. But the frames that I used included the mat. They were beautiful sort of museum frames. They were $12. $12. That was with glass, mat, the whole deal. And they're fabulous. The difference between the image through that presentation, and these are images that I knew well. I had lived with them for a while. They were in my camera roll. They're in my Instagram feed. But when I put them in that frame as a print and presented them to me and the world that way, they became something completely different. And I think another way to distinguish yourself is to have your artwork printed and available, whether it's an aluminum print, whether it's in a frame, whether it's in a book, you know, however you do these things. Taking that next step really does separate you from the other guy. So presentation elevates. And do this experiment for yourself. Take a shot that you're familiar with, that you've looked at 50 times on your smartphone, make a print of it and frame it, and then tell me what you think, all right? It's pretty impressive what happens during that process. And finally, number five, take pride in your work. Now, pride doesn't serve us very well in relationships, right? Pride tends to get in the way in relationships. But when it comes to our work, working so that you feel pride for what you have created does work in our favor, because I think it pushes us to reach a level that we might not achieve had we not been taking pride in what we do. So taking pride in your work, saying that I want to produce stuff that's good. I want to produce quality. I want to produce stuff that is better than what I did before, and hopefully better than what a lot of other people are doing too. Having that sense of pride in your work. And in all honesty, this goes beyond photography. You know, I started out the show talking about the film camera shop and this crazy idea that I had last year that I could get my hands on old film cameras, repair them, clean them, make them look beautiful again, and then make them available to the public, and that the public would actually be interested in buying them and spending a little bit more from them than if they got an old dirty one that may or may not work on eBay. And that was kind of a crazy idea, and I got mixed reviews from people when I floated it by them before I opened the shop. But I tell you, since I have opened the film camera shop, a number of things have happened. First of all, it's been affirming to see that there is a large segment of the population that does appreciate something that is clean and functioning, packaged with care, repaired with care, and shipped with care. There are people who really are interested in that sort of thing. So that's been affirming to feel that quality, you know, still lives in the hearts of a lot of people out there. But the other thing that I didn't expect was how it feels for me as a technician to get these things. And, you know, when I open the box, let's say I buy something on eBay and the guy's selling it as part of an estate sale. And, you know, when you're on eBay a lot, you start to get used to all the kind of the lines, right? The lines like, well, I don't know anything about photography, but it appears to be functioning, you know, stuff like that. Well, you know, they're just doing that. They probably know a lot about photography, and they probably know that it isn't fully functioning. And, you know, they're playing this game with you. All right, fair enough. You know, buyer beware and all that. So I know that. And then I get this thing where they've already kind of weren't perfectly clear in the description about its state of being. And then, you know, they throw it in this, whatever, newspaper bubble wrap or whatever. And then they wrap it with a ball of tape, right? So you get this thing that's just wrapped in packing tape. So then you have to, you have to cut it out, you know, essentially. You have to take the scissors and cut carefully so you don't cut something that's important like a camera strap. And then, you know, and the thing usually smells, right? Because it's been sitting in someone's closet for 20 years or something like that. You get it out, it's dirty, it doesn't smell good, it takes forever to extract it from their, you know, lazy way of packing the thing. And then you hold it there and you look at it, and then when I look at it, I go, there is something here. There is something that I can make beautiful again. And then I take it to the workbench and I work on it. I test it, I find out what's wrong, I fix those things if I can. I clean it up, I make it smell good, I make it look good, I make it function right. And then I hold it out again and look at it and go, that is a beautiful piece of machinery. And that feels good. That pride in taking something and making it beautiful again feels really good. And then to share that with somebody else who I know is going to appreciate the work that I did on, and they're going to use that tool to make beautiful pictures. That, you know, that whole thing is good. So taking pride in your work is a good thing. Having pride in relationships is a dangerous thing. Know when to have pride and when not, and take it from there. So those are five ways that I think that you can separate yourself from the other guy. And these apply to photography for sure, but I think they apply to all sorts of different things in life. And the thing that's happened to me is now I can't go back. I can't go back and do things the other way. And in photography, we get a real payoff when we try to bring quality to what we do, and that payoff is in a beautiful picture that is honestly forever. Me and my Sikonic light meter. So this is a new spot that I'm going to do for the next month, for the month of May, about handheld Sikonic light meters. And this is very interesting. So I have one. I have one right now. If you want to look it up, there's the link in the show notes. It's the Speedmaster L858D. And this is a handheld light meter that can do all sorts of wonderful things. Has an LCD screen, it's a touch screen, and is really an amazing piece of equipment. So I was thinking about this and while I was testing it, while I was using it, and going, well, you know, I want to write about this, and I want to write about this, and I want to talk about this and that. Anyway, I had all these things kind of flooding through my head. And then I said, wait. Okay, hang on a second here, cowboy. What you need to do is, first of all, talk about why would anyone care about using an external handheld light meter, right? We have light meters in our cameras that are quite good. So, Mr. Story, what you should do is first talk about the value of a handheld light meter itself, and then you can talk about, you know, the things that you're using the Sikonic for that you really like. All right, so that's what I'm going to do this week. Let's just talk about why would you want to use an external light meter in the first place, okay? So that's this week's spot. So Here we go. I've got, what do I have here? Oh, I'm going to throw you a curve here. I have four things. You go, oh. See, I had to warn you beforehand, because otherwise you'd be waiting forever for the fifth, right? Where's the fifth? Oh, I have a joke that I should tell sometime about that. It's too long for right now, but I'll remember and I will tell you. Okay, here we go. Here's the first thing about a handheld meter, is that it's not limited to reflected light readings. That's what your camera uses. So the meters in our cameras, they're really good, but they only measure reflected light. So the light bouncing off a subject. Reflected light is influenced by color and darks and lights and all that stuff. That's why we have exposure compensation controls built into our cameras, because they know that reflected light meters can be fooled. They can be fooled by a big dark area. They can be fooled by a bright area. And we know why, right? Because the meter itself is calibrated for more or less a neutral gray. And the thinking being that in an average scene, there are enough darks and there are enough lights where they probably average out more or less to a mid-tone gray if you were to average them all together. Therefore, the light meter has a reasonable chance of making a good reading. And then, of course, our reflected light meters have gotten more sophisticated. So they evaluate different areas of the frame as we're looking at it. They break it into segments, segmented metering. And then they have computer programs written into them that when they see this pattern, it usually means, okay, that must be a landscape because this is a bright sky, and which means the ground's a little bit darker, all this kind of stuff. So then we'll give this sort of meter reading. So the meters in our cameras are quite good, and they've done a lot to compensate for the inherent weaknesses in doing reflected light readings only. But when you start to use a handheld meter, then you start thinking, why are we jumping through all these hoops when all we have to do is take an incident light reading and all those problems are solved? So that's the second point. Handheld meters can do incident light readings. Now, what does that mean? So instead of measuring the light that's bouncing off the subject, incident light readings measure the light directly. So that's when we go over to the subject and we point the light meter really back at the camera so that we can see the light that's coming from the source, or we point it right at the source. So we're not measuring the light bouncing off the subject. We are measuring the light itself directly from the source. So things like colors and shiny areas and white dresses and black jackets and all that sort of stuff, it doesn't influence the measurement at all, because we're not measuring that. We're standing in front of that white dress, in front of that black jacket, in front of that bright yellow scarf, and we are measuring the light that is falling onto those things, not the light that's bouncing off them. Now, obviously, your camera can't do this because it is recording the thing. It can't break itself in half and then, you know, have half of it go over and take an incident light reading. So you need a separate meter to do that. And when you just measure the light itself, and then you take that aperture and that shutter speed, and you plug it into your camera, and you take the picture, and then it just looks right. It just works, because you're just measuring light. And this is the big biggie with handheld light meters, is that you can do this. And not only can you do incident light readings, there are a variety of ways that you can do it. So you can slice and dice even thinner. All right, so that's point number two. Point number three, you can also measure flash output. Now again, our cameras have through the lens light metering for flash, and that's great. And again, they get fooled all the time. And anyone who's ever used TTL metering knows this. The flash is easily fooled. If you take a handheld meter and you just have it measure the light coming off the flash from the distance that is going to be used, then you know exactly how much light is coming. You don't have to worry about being fooled by dark and light and reflected areas and all that kind of stuff. And you get a very accurate reading. The fact that you can measure flash with a handheld meter, that's a big deal. I mean, that's right up there. If you use flash, that's right up there with having the ability to do incident light readings. Okay, so that's the third point. And then finally, and this is something I started getting excited about as I really started to learn about, can help us balance ambient light and flash output in ways that we never dreamed of before. And remember when I was talking about really understanding light in the first segment? Well, this takes fill flash to a new place. Because with fill flash, you know, we were just really trying to get, I don't want the background too bright. I don't want the subject too bright. I don't want the background too dark. I don't want the subject too dark. You know, we're kind of like those very broad brushstrokes. But to be able to say, I want the subject to look like this, and I want the background to look like this, a handheld meter can help us do that because we can measure both the ambient light and we can measure the flash output. And then we can begin to make some adjustments. And then not only that, once we find a formula that we really like, once we find the magic formula that would be our work, we can repeat it because we're dealing with light measurements. So then you know I need the flash output to be a half a stop brighter than the ambient light for this look that I like. And you can repeat that over and over again. And that is really cool. So those are the reasons why you would want to go to the expense and then to carry an extra item in your camera bag for a light meter. Now, I'm going to be the first to tell you, as a nimble photographer, this is not something I'm going to carry all the time. I'm not going to carry a light meter every time I step out the door. But there are shoots, and especially when I'm in two modes. When I'm in commercial mode and I'm working for a client, the confidence of being able to produce a shot that looks great on the back of the LCD when the client is standing there and to nail it on the first shot, that's a big deal. That makes you look really good. So in commercial work, really nice. But then also in creative work where I want to create a specific look, I have something in my head, that light meter can help me create it. So those are two situations where I would want to have the handheld light meter. I'm probably not going to take it with me on street shooting. I'm probably not even going to take it with me to Aunt Jane's birthday party, but when I'm doing commercial work or when I'm doing serious creative work, it can be a really great tool. So we'll dig more into this next week. Wanted to just sort of lay the groundwork here. And in the meantime, if you want to take a look at the Speedmaster L85-8, go ahead and click on the link that I have in the show notes. You can take a look at it, and we'll march forward next week. It's crazy when we start using these new tools that we never really considered before. We start using them, and then we go, wow, I never really realized that. Olympus announces significant firmware updates for the OMD and Pen cameras. This is a report from imagingresource.com. I'm just going to go ahead and read you what they wrote, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. Olympus has announced significant firmware updates that enhance the performance and capability of the OMD EM1 Mark II, OMD EM5 Mark II, and the Pen F, and select Pro and Premium lenses. These updates are available immediately, and for the OMD series cameras includes true compatibility with Profoto Air Remote TTL, a new save settings in MySets, which preserves camera settings on a computer, and mid-tone adjustment, which has been added to highlight and shadow control. Now, some of these things already existed, some in one camera, but not in another, so they're kind of giving us some broad brushstrokes here. With the update, the Pen F will offer touch to select art filters while viewing the effect in real time, and you can set the slowest shutter speed allowed before the camera raises the sensitivity in ISO auto. That one is nice. I like that one. For the EM1 Mark II specifically, high-res shot and focus stacking modes are now compatible with non-Olympus flashes, and AF home settings are saved when the camera is turned off. The M5 Mark II is upgraded to version 3.0, while the Pen F makes its way to version 2. If you click on this link that I have, the Imaging Resource article, then it goes on and it really breaks out what updates are being added to what camera. But basically what Olympus has said is that the top of the line cameras in each category are going to get more firmware updates. And so, you know, the M5 Mark II, the M1 Mark II, and the Pen F are sort of at the top of their respective stacks. And these firmware updates are really terrific. And if you have one of these three cameras, take a look at it. I mean, I think this is something that you're really going to want to do. Now, one person commented, I did a post on this on Facebook, I believe. And one person commented that he felt bad that Olympus seems to have left behind the original EM5. In other words, the original EM5 is not getting these firmware updates like we're seeing for the EM5 Mark II, which is now at version 3.0 in terms of firmware. And there were incremental firmware updates in between the major ones. I totally understand because I have the original EM5 myself, but I also have the EM5 Mark II. And I understand, I kind of wish that my original EM5 would get some of these updates, depending on, you know, what its capabilities are in terms of hardware anyway, because I was thinking, well, it'd be nice to sell that camera, you know, now that I have the Pen F and the EM5 Mark II, but it hasn't been updated in so long, it doesn't have as much value out on the market as my other cameras. Whereas if it had these firmware updates, I think it would have more value out in the market, which means I could probably sell it. So I totally agree that I wish these other cameras would get firmware updates too. But the fact of the matter is it seems that Olympus is going to focus on the cameras that are their flagship cameras in the respective categories. That being said, I'm glad that they're doing this because these firmware updates are great. And, you know, they really added a lot of life to the first EM1. Through firmware updates. Those were big updates. And my EM5 Mark II has continued to improve and hold its value because of these updates. And it looks like they're going to do the same thing for the Pen F. On one hand, I'm thrilled with these firmware updates. On the other hand, I do have some sympathy for those that have the older cameras. Anyway, if you want to read more, the link is in the show notes. These are nice updates and they're definitely worth doing. Speaking of updates, I've got just a few here for you before we wrap up for today. We have B&H and Amazon tiles on all the pages of the Digital Story. If you're going to buy from B&H or Amazon, if you go to that tile first, click on it, and then go to wherever you're going to go on those respective sites. That helps support this site. Every now and then, I get an email from someone that says that the Amazon tile isn't showing. And that is a browser compatibility situation. I don't really have a list from Amazon of which versions of all the browsers that we need. But I will say this, that if you go to do this, if you go to do this good thing, and then the Amazon tile isn't there, you go, well, here I am trying to do this good thing. And, you know, now this happens. Derek, he's like just wasting my time. If you could just open the Digital Story in another browser, in a different browser, chances are very good it'll be there. We get the code from Amazon. We get the code from B&H. So we don't write the code ourselves. So sometimes we're as perplexed as anyone else when something doesn't appear to be working the way that we anticipate it will. Wacky, isn't it? Anyway, those of you that do it, and it feels like a lot of you are doing it, thank you so much. Because it really does help. It helps a lot. And speaking of helping a lot, a big thanks to our Patreon members, members of our inner circle, who support this site month after month. The difference, I think, between the Patreon inner circle and then some of these other things that I'm talking about, affiliate stuff with Amazon, sponsorships and so forth, is that the Patreon, I can budget. So I know what that number is each month because I see it. It's right there on my account. Whereas, let's say the affiliate money coming in from B&H and Amazon, that number one month can be whatever, and another month it could be half of whatever or a third of whatever. So it's not as predictable. So the one thing, or one of the things, that the Patreon members are doing for us that's so cool is that it's budgetable. I know how much is coming in there, so then I know how much I can spend on admin. I know how much I can spend on, you know, working on the site and all those sort of things. So that's the one thing that you guys are doing that's really wonderful, is not only are you ponying up, but it is something that can be a line item in my budget for the site that really helps me plan not only for the month at hand, but for future months. And thank you so much for helping me do that. And then finally, I want to thank the good folks at Red River Paper. They have been so much on my mind lately because I'm working on that ebook, which they have underwritten in a very nice way. I tell you, I mean, total support on this. And they are providing me with whatever paper I need to do this ebook. So this is really great, which means then I can experiment, which means then I can try these different stocks because I know that they'll send it to me. And the one thing that I'm really learning as I'm working on this ebook is how many different ways printing can be wonderful. You know, we sometimes just think that printing is wonderful in the sense of, you know, putting a picture in a frame, putting it on the wall, which is wonderful. But some of these other ways that I'm using this paper is really cool and really interesting. Appreciate Red River Paper standing behind me. And I have to tell you, their paper is great. I'm experimenting with stocks I haven't used before, and I'm loving it. So thanks a lot to Red River Paper. They have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story, longest running sponsor of the site. And they have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/Red River Paper. That is going to do it for me this week. I hope you have a good week shooting. I hope you go out and make something beautiful. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll see you next week. Until then, bye-bye now.